a town.
Chapter one.
All right. We're into the double digits of you doing that, so that's enough.
He adored New York.
No!
He idolized it all out of proportion.
You're listening to a very special episode of the Important Cinema Club, where we're live from New York City.
Starring Justin Declue.
Wait, what is that a reference to?
That's Don Pardo, the announcer of Saturday Night Live.
Oh, I've never watched that show. I'm just kidding. All these bits you're listening, like Saturday Night Live, have been tested in front of a live studio audience.
Yeah, that's why they're so good. So if you're listening to this podcast for the first time ever, don't listen to this
episode. Go to a different episode.
This is a special report. This is the Important Cinema Club does Manhattan.
And we are literally in Manhattan right now, live from the hotel room where me and Will have had all of our adventures. Man, I went down a sentence I could not get out of.
It's the Royalton Park Avenue. Come to room 805 if you want to experience, you know, re-experience, follow in our footsteps.
Yeah, it's like going to the hotel room where some famous person was when they died or something like that.
Yeah, like where Sid shot Nancy, that sort of thing, which, you know, the day is young. It could still happen.
And if you're wondering, wait, why are they in New York City? First of all, we are cultured men who come down to take in said culture of the world's greatest city. Number two, we wanted to meet Bruce Lee.
Yeah, so Bruce Lee, who actually it's pronounced Bruce Lee.
I know, I'm going to get it wrong. I realized it when I said it.
For decades, I've been calling it Bruce Lee. And last week we promised you an episode on Bruce Lee, and that is coming. Mm-hmm. It is coming very soon. But we came because, first of all, let's define our terms. Bruce Lee is one of the world's greatest Bruce Lee impersonators. In the 1970s, the Bruce Bruceploitation film movement, all those Bruce Lee knockoff movies, you had Bruce Lee, you had Dragon Lee, then you had Bruce Lee. And for years, there was no information about Bruce Lee in the English-speaking world. He made these Bruce Lee ripoff movies in the 70s and 80s and then seemingly disappeared. Well, he's back. He's in a documentary called Enter the Clones of Bruce, and it's touring all over the United States. He's gone on a multi-city tour. It's Bruce Lee's first time in the United States since 1983, his first time in New York ever.
And so we basically came down to come see him. Not even basically, that's why we came down.
And then I started working my contacts because it's like, okay, well, I have to meet him. I have to interview him. Like, we have to be in a room with him.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a commission to interview him.
And, yes.
And that's
we did,
great.
But hey, that's a little bit of a tease of something that's probably going to be discussed a little bit later in this episode. Because first, I thought it would be fun to talk about New York as like a film city, something that we've experienced before, and that when we come, we have very specific goals in mind that we want to go and do.
Right. So when you come to New York, first of all, what is your perception of New York? When you think of New York as a Torontonian, what are the film things that you salivate over, you want to go to? And when you come here, what do?
MoMA. Spectacle, other theaters that are playing, the Metrograph, which I had never visited, Nighthawk, if anything is playing.
Woody Allen's house.
Yes. Did me and Will discuss, can we go walk and look at Woody Allen's house? Can we record an episode in front of it?
Wouldn't that be so funny if we went and pulled out the mic just in front of his house?
The cops come. They're like, you're coming with us.
Soon-Yi comes out with a broom and starts waving at us like, go away.
But no, instead, it's mostly movie theaters that I think of. And there's a lot of them, and I love visiting them. Like the Nighthawk. I remember, what did I see there? Or the Film Forum. I saw a documentary about Ricky Jay many, many years ago.
I think Film Forum was the first theater I went to here when I was a teenager visiting. And I haven't been there in years, but like when I was here for a year, that was the place I went to the most because they would always like play 35 millimeter film back then.
Oh, wait, you used to live in New York, Will?
Here's the thing. Like I tried to
the
say,
glint in my eye.
I tried to say that as casually as possible because it's like Jonathan Rosenbaum talking about his time in Paris.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be there. And yet.
Yeah, I mean, you don't
talk
about
it that. We are in New York.
We are in New York, so it's a good example. I mean, when you came to New York, you went to journalism school, right?
That is correct.
And was there a lot of like film sights and sounds that you set up for yourself or you did on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, not because of journalism school exactly, but I definitely like... Well, to mention Woody Allen, like, and this is before all the unpleasantness.
Oh, yes.
But, like, I went to see him play clarinet.
Which sounds, in your words, the most embarrassing thing, almost contractually obligated by Mr. Allen.
Well, you know, he comes out.
Wait, I need to make a correction. You said before the unpleasantness. unpleasantness. No, after the unpleasantness.
I mean, it's a room at the Carlisle Hotel full of the most monstrous looking European tourists. And, you know, some of us film fans standing at the bar, because back then you would pay $90 US.
$90!
To stand at the bar, and you also had to have a minimum $30 drink bill. But because each drink is $25, it ends up being like, you know.
Yeah, so.
But it was all worth it.
Just like a human zoo.
Just to see the woodman in person.
Who came out?
He came out, the whole band's out, okay? His jazz quartet or whatever. And then seconds before the show starts, he comes out, he looks up at the audience, waves, then looks down, doesn't look up again for 2 hours. Then at the end, he looks up and he waves and he goes.
He did a 2-hour show?
Yeah, he did. It was great. If you like Dixieland jazz, I don't know.
Which is your favorite, right?
I don't know if he still does it. Probably not.
I can't imagine he still does.
He's really old.
Yeah. But all right, let's move away from Woody Allen for at least
please,
a minute
please.
Before we get back. And let's talk about you get here, you arrive before me, and you went to the MoMA. That was like one of your go-to places.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the MoMA to see art.
Even though the MoMA has a rich screening series that's organized by David Kerr.
I mean, I fantasize about the MoMAs and Dave Kerr's programming, because it really feels like the theater that is, and I say this affectionately, for the olds.
Mm.
You know, that's where they play the Hollywood studio stuff.
Pass away, probably.
Yeah, the stuff that Dave Kerr likes. And, you know, you've seen the documentary Cinemania,
mm-hmm.
which, if you haven't seen it, everyone should. It's a documentary about the film freaks, you know, the ones who spend all their waking lives in New York going to see movies. Maladjusted, interesting people.
Angry people.
Yeah, old people. Yeah. Like the MoMA, that's where you get to see that.
Especially that the MoMA, if you get a membership, which is very cheap, you can actually see as many movies as you want because it covers that.
Yeah, and maybe I'm being simplistic about the programming there. I remember going to see, like, Police Story there once. I saw Plan 9 from Outer Space there.
I saw when they did, like, a Lost Treasures of Poverty Row series they did. And it was a movie I don't think even ever came out. I looked for it. They do programming a lot that, like, I've emailed Dave Kerr about it, about an Edward L. Kahn film that he played, Laughter in the Dark, and he said only a print exists. They've never done a scan. It's never played anywhere.
Wow.
The only way to see it is if someone books the print.
Wow.
So that's the kind of amazing programming you get. And MoMA crowds, as I've talked about on the other episode, were the wildest crowd I've ever seen. Not like in the movie, just like fighting. We see each other opening like tinfoil, packages of tinfoil.
Well, if you go to the MoMA, you have to bring the crinkliest bag.
Yes.
It's the same with Film Forum, too. That's another good theater for the olds. Bring the crinkliest bag. Also, make sure you bring small candies to unwrap really slowly.
Yes.
And because it's, and that's part of the experience. It's like Rocky Horror Picture Show.
And show up 10 minutes late and yell at someone sitting in your seat.
Oh, and if you're at Film Forum, make sure that you laugh really ostentatiously at anything in an old movie that seems kind of old.
Ugh. I remember one of the people at our screening, they were so rowdy that they got kicked out. Someone had to come in, get them, and like make them leave.
You know, I didn't go on this trip, but my favorite theater in New York, the one that means the most to me, is Anthology Film Archives.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even look at what was playing at Anthology Film Archives.
In the Lower East Side. I mean, again, during my year in New York,
yeah.
I so romanticized. That was the place that probably had the biggest long-lasting impact on me. Like, I would go on weekend afternoons, and they would always be showing, just perpetually, as if on a loop.
We're showing Warhol's Empire State Building. All of it.
Yeah, stuff like that. Stuff like the Kuchar Brothers, Stan Brackage out the wazoo.
Well, for me, I've had experiences watching Kung Fu marathons there over weekends.
Oh, man. Yeah, so Grady Hendrix, he might not do it anymore, but
for, yeah, it's been a while.
But annually, he would do in January or February, like a 5-movie Golden Age of Hong Kong marathon. I know you've gone, I've gone, mm-hmm. and
I went to a weekend he did of like multiple movies.
Oh my God. So yeah, I saw 5 movies in a row 1 year. I think this was 2017, 2018. Organized Crime, Triad Bureau, Kickboxer's Tears.
Joyous. And you don't know what's coming up either. That's the whole gimmick of it.
And like, I remember at the end being absolutely worn out and exhausted, but also like time changes when you're watching these movies. Like, just all one after another. And also to see like five Hong Kong action movies in a row, you get a sense of this incredible spirit that was happening in Hong Kong in the 80s and 90s, as if there was this virus of creativity just flowing through the city.
I think Grady said, like, I just don't have any more to show, like any like weird discoveries or things like that that no one's ever seen.
Maybe how about replay them? I don't know.
Maybe I ruined it for him where they put up like very obscure hints at the beginning. And one of them I was like, hey, it's the magic crane. And he went, no, it's not. It's something completely different. And it was the magic crane.
Ah, yes.
It's too mainstream now. All these movies like the Chui Hark produced Benny Chan directed Magic Crane. He needs to go back into the archives and find even more obscure ones.
So something else I like to do whenever I'm in New York is hit up all the bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking like such an out of towner. That is what
you?
I am.
Oh, wow. The buildings are so tall here.
Well, hey, you know, we were down at Wall Street the other day. Buildings are really tall down there. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm.
And so we went to Forbidden Planet and The Strand. And you may be saying, Forbidden Planet, isn't that a comic book store? I don't know who's organizing it now. I know it was the guy who was called Horror Boobs. Mm-hmm. But he had just a wall of DVDs and Blu-rays that he bought, opened, watched, and then put back on the shelf for sale.
Horror Boobs. That was a great zine. Mm-hmm. That, I don't know if it still exists. It has an online presence. It was exactly what it sounds like. Horror boobs in horror movies.
Is that really? That's all it was about?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I think it had a little more than that. I should dig up some issues from the archives.
And so, speaking of issues, the wall at the back of the store is covered in zines.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's a particular section for movie zines that we always like to go to. Here's my thing about zines. I love zines. Obviously, I collect them. I wish there were more zines about things that aren't just horror movies.
Yeah. I did pick up a zine. It's like, look, this zine's about Donald Sutherland.
Okay, so but what zine did you find? You found something incredible.
I did. It was a zine called Subterranean Cinema, Missing Pieces of the U.S. Video Underground. I have a rule with zines is that, like, if I can crack them open and read about a filmmaker or a film that I've never heard about, that's an instant buy for me.
Yes, but if you crack it open and it's like another article about Dario Argento.
Friday the 13th, which one's the best? Right. I put that one back up on the shelf.
Right.
And so this zine, basically the guy who wrote it, Vincent A. Alburano, I didn't realize when I bought the zine, he wrote a book called Aesthetic Deviations, A Critical View of American Shot on Video Horror.
Right, have you got that?
Of course I got that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
yeah. It's good.
Published by Head Press. And he was inspired by a magazine called Independent Video that only lasted 11 issues. It was like a self-published thing. But basically the gimmick was the editor wanted filmmakers to send in like making ofs of their movies. So it was all populated by like the Polonia brothers, Todd Sheets, J.R. Bookwalter was writing articles. But it's also got like hundreds to thousands of ads for movies that do not exist, that have never made it out, like on DVD or Blu-ray. It's like you could buy it directly from the filmmaker. Maybe they sold 10 copies, but now it's gone.
Yeah.
So this author got obsessed with like tracking down these movies and also tracking down the people that made those movies.
And one of the people he covers is Brian Fortin, who real heads will know as being one of the main actors in the Moturn Media movies.
And the reason he's an actor in those Moturn Media movies is that Charlie and Matt were obsessed with a public access show he had called Zones of Evil. And now speak of lost media. Like Zones of Evil is a show he at one point was doing weekly. Never recorded copies, never digitized them.
But he would interview like people from horror movies.
Yep,
you know?
All the time. And it was like very pure and from his perspective. And what this zine, I captured 23 page article where there's an intro. He goes through all of the basically fan films that Brian Fortin directed, which are all Halloween related, like Michael Myers. And what's fascinating is that the author says that like they create a giant continuity throughout all the films where Brian Fortin plays the same character and his friends and loved ones are killed and that has repercussions in the next movie. And all these movies, you won't find them online anywhere. You'd have to get them directly from Brian.
Well, I met Brian Fortin very briefly at the Moturn Extravaganza.
He rules, yeah.
And I bought all of his zines, which smelled like cigarette smoke.
That means they're authentic.
I've never smelled something that smelled like cigarette smoke more than his zines.
When I go through my library and I hit his magazines, like,
if you were smoking in the room right now, it would smell less like cigarette smoke. But I got lung cancer just holding them. And but I asked him like, are we ever going to get Zones of Evil like online? And he was like, oh, you know, I tried to digitize a tape once and the VCR ate it up, so I don't want to do that.
Mm.
It's like, can somebody, like Martin Scorsese, if you're listening, can the Film Foundation get on this?
And Brian, he goes to conventions, he sells stuff. He's a local celebrity, basically, in the area where the show would play. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to know, like, a deep dive into his stuff. I interviewed him on one of the Moturn discs, and he was so nice, and we've chit-chatted. He sent me, like, an episode of Zones of Evil on a scratch DVD-R that, like, I could play maybe 10 minutes of it, which the author of the zine also discusses. And there's tons of books, too, at Forbidden Planet. I picked one up and I was like, oh, what's this? Interviews that I did as a teenager in my zine. And I looked at the name. I was like, Sam Irving? Where do I know that? Oh my gosh, that's a guy that I interviewed who directed Christmas movies. I was like, gotta buy this book.
Yeah, a Hallmark, well, not Hallmark, but a Hallmark adjacent Christmas movie director.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to that interview, we did it a couple years ago. It's a great interview. He's a really funny and fascinating guy. And I had no idea he published a book. Like, I feel like me and you, we're pretty tapped into this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's still some that are just falling through the cracks that we've never heard of.
So let's talk about The Strand, which is the most famous bookstore in New York. 16 miles of books, I think that's what they say. Can I just say, let's get us in there to chop down.
Yeah.
Like
let's chop this shit down.
There are too many books.
Yeah.
You don't need 25 copies of Lena Dunham's autobiography, mm-mm, okay? 16 miles of books, we can cut that down to 1 mile easily. Mm. Of just the good stuff. Nicely curated.
I gotta say, walking through that whole bookstore, looking at all the points of interest for me and you, the BMVs in Toronto are better.
Yeah, and we went to the Metrograph, and their little bookstore there, which is just a corner of the building.
Oh, well, that one rules. That's curated by someone we know.
Yeah, Nick Pinkerton curates it, and it's beautifully curated. Every book is good there, and I bought about 20 copies of Sight and Sound.
Yeah, just old Sight and Sounds that were sitting there. Will's like, all right, I'm going to get all of these.
Yeah.
I got a book about a Hungarian film critic who was the first to write about film semiotics, but it's not a book of his writing. It's a biography about him, yeah. That's super long and in English. I was like, yep, I have to pick up this. But Strand, so what are we looking? Like, what are we looking for when we go to this?
You go to the Strand, and what you're looking for are books that are old and out of print, preferably by somebody who was working on Poverty Row, mm-hmm, or in the silent film industry. If you can find a child star who worked in Westerns, or if you could find a leading lady from silent movies who has never been heard of. Mm.
Look for anything by Scarecrow Press. Mm. They were a press in, I think, the 80s and 90s, who basically, if there was a blacklisted screenwriter, they'd be like, can we get a diary of your time in Mexico, of just making movies there, and then boom, that's a book.
Man, I had a great score when I went to Spoonbeam and Sugartown in Williamsburg the other day. I got Eddie Cantor's autobiography.
Wait, who's Eddie Cantor, for people who don't know?
Eddie Cantor was a vaudevillian. He was also a movie star, and I couldn't tell you any more than that.
But you're excited to read the book, right, Will? Not just put it on your shelf and...
No, thing is, it's pretty thin.
Oh,
and
nice.
It looks like mostly anecdotal. It's like I opened it to a random page. It's like there's a chapter on my memories of Al Jolson. And it's like, hey, maybe there are some good memories here.
Now, another trick that you have is you'll get a book. Like, I pull it excitedly off the shelf. Whoa, a book about Carl Strauss. Carl Strauss shot Sunshine. Anyway, I cracked the book open. I was like, no. This is mostly pictures. No.
What I also like about bookstores in this city is you can get, the real nice, beautiful, small press books that come to New York first. So we go to Metrograph, and Metrograph has created a beautiful little zine of Zoe Lund's poetry. Zoe Lund from Ms. 45 also wrote Bad Lieutenant, died tragically very young. Mm-hmm. I have this beautiful little thing of her poems now.
Yeah, that's what you want. You want those little weird things. And when you go to a bookstore like The Strand, sometimes hard to find that.
Now, speaking of Metrograph, we went to a couple of movie theaters that represent aesthetically, vibes-wise, kinds of point-counterpoint to each other. So Metrograph.
Which I checked, of course, being like, all right, what's playing? Will, there's a 16mm Porky Pig showcase that's playing.
Oh my God. So I was in heaven during this. Metrograph, very beautiful theater, a little diamond in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
A fancy theater for fancy folks like you and me.
Yeah, so when we show up at 11:30 a.m., we take our seats for the Porky Pig showcase. I gotta say, a very nice theater, very small.
Beautiful.
As Will said, looking out, it's like, man, I wish we had a theater like this in Toronto. We could sell this one out.
Yeah, that's right. So the Porky Pig showcase all 16mm. I mean, my
God. Well, I made a joke when we were going in that I said it was going to be all people our age, and it'll also be maybe one dad with a daughter.
And if not people our age, people older.
Older, yeah. But we will say, we sit down, and I'm like, wow, it's a pretty packed house. This rules. And then someone comes in and goes, if you're here for the other screening, it's in the other theater. And then, like, half the audience gets up and leaves.
Yeah.
And did a older man with his very young daughter come in right at the beginning? Yes, he did.
That's right. We had at least one child in the room. Quorum was achieved.
And so Porky Pig Showcase starts up. We're introduced with some of these are TV prints. Some of these.
All of them are TV prints. Yeah. I mean, this is what I love. Listen, you can get your beautiful Blu-ray quality Porky Pig cartoons. But what I like are like the shit, like, you know, they've been
battered.
Yeah. Back in the 1970s, they had early colorization done to them. they have weird like logos of out of business companies at the beginning.
Yeah. Like Seventh Art. And you see like all your favorite Looney Tunes character. It's Bugs and who the hell is that guy?
Bosco. and the cartoons that we saw were all great because they're all like early or like pre-1948 Porky Pig cartoons.
I had only seen one, and Will had definitely seen the one with live action elements in it before.
You Ought to Be in Pictures, it's called, where you get to see Porky shake hands with Warner Brothers cartoon president Leon Schlesinger.
And we also watched Porky's Midnight Matinee, which was hideous in a way that I couldn't pinpoint. Because it was supposed to be directed by Chuck Jones, and it looked weird, and I realized after looking it up afterwards, it's because it was recolored, which is something we don't deal with that much now, the idea of like, oh, these black and white cartoons are hideously recolored.
Yeah, it's like it was retraced.
Yeah, even. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, so, but there were also other cartoons that were like, you know, in color originally that we saw black and white prints of.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting experience. Some of the cartoons were really great, though, like Baby Bottleneck by Bob Clampett, which is a masterpiece.
I love it. It's so good.
It's an incredible cartoon, one of Clampett's best, but it also has an amazing scene where Porky is like briefly stripped and a diaper is put on him. And
so you see full nude Porky.
Yeah, there's a half second, and I'm very aware that Porky Pig never wears pants. Everyone's joked about that. But like when he doesn't have the jacket on, that seems obscene.
And that was a fun one because all of these cartoons were like wild chaos Daffy Duck before he became put upon star Daffy Duck, mm-hmm. where Daffy, like in My Favorite Duck, the whole gag is he's just torturing Porky Pig mercilessly.
Mm-hmm.
We also saw a very old Porky cartoon, which the whole gimmick was, what if you got a wife?
She
gained a bunch of weight and she beat you with a rolling pin. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah, Porky's Romance from 1937. Check it out. It's actually the debut of
Petunia Pig?
Your favorite character, Petunia Kit Pig. And she actually has a huge buildup. It's like there's an opening where it's like Leon Schlesinger presents his new Looney Tunes cartoon find.
Starring Petunia Pig.
It's like, oh, I was hoping it might be Daffy. I don't know.
And we also watch one where it's Porky versus a cat that won't let him sleep. That one was great because Porky had like bags under his eyes for half the short. He looked like he was absolutely losing his mind.
Yeah, it's called Notes to You from 1941. Check it out because you will see a suicidal and murderous Porky Pig.
Well, and it ends with Porky Pig committing suicide off screen.
Yeah, I guess he survived though.
Yeah, oh, wait, are you thinking that all the Looney Tunes cartoons are in continuity?
Yeah, this is actually, yeah, they're not in continuity. This is actually canonically the final one. Like within the diegesis.
So it's like almost Proustian. We're jumping it through time.
It takes place after Space Jam, A New Legacy, like yeah. whatever the most recent one was. Yeah.
All right. So after that, Will had an outing for us on the next day.
Oh, man. So we went with our good friend Violet Luca out to Flushing. And you might say, why go to Flushing? Well, what if I told you that Angela Mao, the great martial arts actress from the 1970s, star of Hapkido, star of Lady Whirlwind, co-star of Enter the Dragon, mm-hmm. for Christ's sake.
Okay. Co-star is a strong word, considering she's in one scene.
She has a very memorable scene,
mm-hmm.
And a star-making scene.
Well, it famously came out, in our circles, of course, like 2016, that she runs a restaurant, multiple restaurants.
Because Angela Mao was the biggest female martial arts star. Disappeared.
Yeah. No one knows where she went.
No one knew what happened to her. And then, it found out she ran a dim sum place in Flushing. And I think now she runs three.
Mm-hmm. So I had to warn Will. I'm like, Will, if we're going to the restaurant, she may not be there.
Yeah, and I was comfortable with that.
Yeah.
It's like, it's fine. It's just about soaking in the vibes. And
we walk in through the door, and she's right there.
She's right there. Yeah. She's right there, like just running the restaurant.
Yeah, she's like, oh, I can show you to your table. Let's go.
And I'm like, this is fucked up. Like, and then it's also like there's a feeling of like, okay, three white people show up.
She knows what's going on.
She knows who we are.
Yeah.
She doesn't know who we are, but
she knows
what we represent.
Yeah. So we go in, we order food, we look over at the table, we see three other white guys.
Yeah, three other white guys. Otherwise, the restaurant is, you know, completely
local
like
people.
Asian diaspora.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we have a lovely lunch, and the whole time I'm just like, you know, looking over at Angela Mao, being like, oh.
Just sitting there, leaning back, talking to someone.
And I'm thinking like, well, what would I say to Angela Mao?
Yeah.
Nothing. But then I also think, wouldn't it be weirder if, like, I didn't?
I think she'd be fine with it, like, yeah. if you paid for your food and then just went.
So I did.
But we saw, though, the white guys did take photos with her.
And that also, that gave a certain permission. So on the way out, I simply shook her hand and said, big fan, thank you.
She went, ah! Yeah. But you went, thank you.
Yeah, very, very polite.
I was just happy to be in her presence, to be like, we went to a restaurant and Angela Mao was just running it. I'm literally like the most famous woman martial artist.
It's amazing. Like just, yeah, yeah. So I had a great time.
Saturday, I think that's the best time to go, like around noon one, because she works. So everybody's all hands on deck around that time.
And please, don't be a freak.
Be polite, yeah.
Don't be a freak, okay?
No.
If you go on our recommendation, just be normal.
Yes. I mean, you could politely maybe ask for a photo at the end. Like, that's fine, but don't be like, ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, she's used to it. You know she
don't
is.
Ask a bunch of questions.
No, no, don't ask.
Bruce Lee.
Don't mention Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
I mean,
maybe she'd be fine with it, but just for yourself, don't be a freak.
Yeah, don't be a freak.
So I said that we went to two theaters that are sort of aesthetically a point counterpoint. There's the Metrograph, and then we looked at two different Alamo Drafthouse locations. Y'all know Drafthouse. You get to order, you know, the food in your seat, and they deliver it to you.
Don't have projectionists anymore, I think.
Yeah, yeah. a little weird, but that's where we saw, you know, Bruce Lee, that's how it's pronounced, did appearances at both the Lower Manhattan and the Staten Island ones, and we followed him around like fish.
So at the first place, which was Lower Manhattan, I gotta say, as I was walking in, I went, wait, isn't there like a Alamo where they installed the Kim's Video Stock, the famous video store that shut down many years ago? And I looked on my phone as we were going down an escalator and I went, oh, it's this one.
Yeah. And so Kim's Video, I guess, was sort of like the Cahiers du Cinema of New York filmmakers of the 2000s. You know, Sean Price Williams.
Alex Ross Perry.
The Safdies, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people like that worked or orbited there. And the collection, when it closed down, as all video stores do, the collection, for some reason, was sold to a small village in Italy. And it went over there. It was to become like some kind of an archive. And that didn't happen. So friends of Kim's reclaimed the collection and had it installed in the basement of this Alamo Drafthouse movie theater.
It's not the whole collection, obviously.
It's just the good stuff.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good stuff.
Man, and you can rent movies there for free, mostly on VHS. And a lot of them, like, I don't know, you look around, all these, like, Something Weird tapes. There's, like, a local New York filmmakers section. So you'll get, like, you know, Nick Zedd, Beth B., Andy Warhol.
Some of the original tapes that were released at that time are just sitting there.
Like, Nick Zedd himself was, like, photocopying these tapes and mm-hmm. sending them to the video stores.
So this rules, took a lot of photos being like, what's that? I don't know. One of them was just like American Hell Warzone. And I was like, I don't know what this is. I looked it up. There's no reference. It was just a white sheet that someone had written the name on it and then put it on the shelf. So that was a delight. And then we went in, watched the movie. We'll talk about it more on the main episode about Bruce Lee. Oh man, I'm never going to get this right.
Bruce Lee.
Yeah, that's right.
Bruce Lee is very different.
I will say, as we went to go see Challenge of the Tiger, which was the second feature, and I walked out, Bruce was walking in, he looked up, we nodded, and then he saw, oh, it's the guy that interviewed me, and then he tapped me gently on the shoulder as I went in.
What a great feeling.
Yeah.
Bruce Lee remembered you and felt fondly of you.
Yeah, that's right.
So then the next day, we checked out the Staten Island Drafthouse, which I believe is owned by the RZA.
It's not owned by the RZA. I think he was involved in designing it,
okay.
Is the way that it went about.
And I'm wondering if it's his poster collection there,
mm-hmm.
because it's basically a museum of
yeah.
like martial arts movie posters.
That's just in a strip mall.
Yeah.
Like you walk in, it just looks like a normal mall.
There's an Applebee's across the street.
Yep, but yeah. If you go up the stairs on the second floor, There's the Alamo, and you walk in, there's a big bar, like designed like an old martial arts movie set. There's little plaques all over the place. But the real reason is, man, those posters, and it goes on and on and on.
Oh, we just had such a great time looking at, you know, Lebanese Bruceploitation posters, or these like giant bus stop sized like Jackie Chan posters, including a poster for the big brawl, you know, the size of a wall, titled La Chinoise.
Yeah, and Jackie, you've seen the photo of the big brawl. He's like, oh, he looks really tough. Not in this French poster, because he has a big smile on his face.
Yeah, just very strange. And, you know, Godfrey Ho posters, like Revenge of the Shogun Women, you know.
A lot of us staring at the poster and going, what is this movie?
A little section for Jackie exploitation posters. Mm-hmm. I mean, God.
There was, what was the poster that I was looking at? And I was like, filmed in 70 millimeter. Now that's a lie.
Oh yeah, that was, okay. That was a great poster because it was a poster for Bruce Lee's Ninja Strikes Back. Didn't have that title on it. It had a big picture of Bruce Lee, like, doing a karate kick over the Roman Colosseum.
That's right.
So you think, oh, if you're an idiot, you look at it and you think, oh, it was Way of the Dragon, mm-hmm. where he fought there.
Well, not if you're an idiot. If you are just a normal human being, you're right. See this poster.
You're right. If you're a normal human being. And also because it literally says, starring Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Lee.
Like it's saying Bruce Lee.
Lee.
Yes.
And then it also, you know, but then, you know, if you're perceptive, if you're wise and smart like us, you look at the rest of the cast and say,
oh, I don't think Chick Norris is in this movie.
Chick Norris.
Yep.
And you see the name Dick Randall as producer.
It's
like alarm bells.
Yep.
And then that's
alarm bells as in like, oh, I got a winner here.
And it said shot in 70 millimeter.
Untrue.
I mean, if you unspool all the film and measure it, it's probably much more than 70 millimeters.
So me and Will, we had a delightful time walking. I wish there was a bigger gift shop of like martial arts related things there.
And also Bruce Lee was there because there was another Q&A happening.
He was just on his phone.
We had the weird side of Bruce Lee, this martial arts star who is a mythical figure to me, somebody I never imagined even existing in the flesh. You know, there he is just looking at his phone.
Rule.
Awesome.
And then I said, Will, we have to do one more thing. Let's visit the Museum of Moving Images.
So from Staten Island to way out in Queens, we had a nice 90-minute transit ride, mm-hmm. made it to the Museum of the Moving Image, which, what if I told you that they have a reconstruction of Robin Williams' makeup?
Hello!
From Mrs. Doubtfire.
Well, they do.
You were having a lot of fun looking at all the cameras.
Mm-hmm. Will was more of the 5-year-old boy being like, come on, let's go. Well, I'm like, look at this camera. They use this to shoot Passion of Joan of Arc.
But they also have a Jim Henson exhibit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, taking a look at, you know, I went into it thinking, I don't really care all that much about Jim Henson. But then you see the Statler and Waldorf puppets. And it's like, God, I love these guys.
Ah, these guys rule.
And you see the Big Bird costume. And it's like, that bird's too big.
Yep. And
how do you get that big?
Will kept walking and went, ugh, not Muppets? No, thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's like if they had the Muppets from Saturday Night Live.
I mean, you're excited about that.
The Land of Groot. And I think that's great. I thought they might have just burned those Muppets in shame. But yeah. No, they were there.
Have you ever watched those segments?
Yeah, of course I have.
Not very funny, I would say.
No, I've seen pretty much the whole first season of SNL.
Wow, dedicated. On Comedy Central, like Against Your Will, or... Wait, what was... It wasn't Comedy Central in Canada. What was it called?
It was the Comedy Network.
Okay, completely legally distinct.
That's right.
And yeah, Museum of Moving Images, $20. Super fun. Great game. Gift shop with a lot of well-curated books. Too many, I would say.
Yeah. So I also want to ask you one more thing. This isn't quite movie-related, but you went to this incredible comic book warehouse.
Yeah, Joseph Koch's comic book warehouse.
At the bottom tip of Brooklyn. Now, you've taken me here before.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like,
they have about 100,000 comics
and
there.
And you go in, and it feels like Dante's Inferno.
Yes.
Like, there are animals, like everywhere.
There's one cat.
there's no ventilation, so, you can get heat stroke in there. And I say this all with affection.
Like, what's wild about this place is I could get the most obscure comic in the world. And this is what you want. You want the obscure stuff. Because if you want, like, popular things, you're probably not going to find them.
Yeah.
But if you want, like, I wanted a comic called A Boy and His Robot that was published in 1987, just one printing. Went through the archives, they had 3 copies.
Yeah.
And this is my Shangri-La. I love this place, and I can spend hours and hours and After this recording, will I be going before I go to the airport? Maybe, to pass the time. Also because they're closing down in about a month.
Oh, man.
That they're going to get rid of all this. It's been open for decades.
The guy who runs it is in his 80s now.
So. Yeah. Well, he's an older man. I don't know how quite old he is. He still answers the phone. He's like, hey, it's Joe of Joe Koch's Comic Book Warehouse. So if you are around New York and you're interested in I would say, though, like, try to figure out what you're looking for, because it's all alphabetical.
When I've been there, it's been overwhelming.
Yes.
And I love this place. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. But, like, I literally get dizzy walking through these aisles. There's so much stuff.
And the prices are great right now, because I gave him a pile. Last time I went, he looked them up on, like, the Comic Buyer's Guide. This time he just went, yeah, $2, $3, and count how many you have. And then I came to him, it's this much. He went, okay, that's good. Here you go, pay. So if you're interested in comic book or even like weird toy detritus, I didn't look at the toys this time. Didn't even want to glance at them because I don't want to have to get any big boxes I need to bring home. Last time I went home was a giant Puppet Master toy. So none of that this time. But yeah, that is one of my, I was so happy it was open when we were here, but it won't be open for very long. So if you're listening to this and you live in the New York area, go to this place.
Finally, we didn't go to the Spectacle Theater. We meant to, but we got the
times I got the
wrong.
Times wrong.
But I do want to give a shout out to the Spectacle because it's a beautiful place.
Never visited.
It's basically like a room in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You know, this like very ad hoc.
Not a Cineforum.
Okay, well, that's an obscure Toronto reference.
Well,
yes.
If they listen to the last episode, they've heard it.
That's right. It's not Retch Hart. It's, mm-hmm. it's a sort of cooperatively run community theater in Brooklyn, like just in the Williamsburg
area. And they have amazing programming.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, yeah, just one room. It probably seats like 50 or so, like on a really packed night. Mm-hmm. And the programming they'll do is like the most obscure, you know, like what sort of things do they show?
They played Open Doom Crescendo a lot, the Terry Chu movie.
Or our friend Nate Wilson's film, the All Golden.
But they also do like a very obscure Japanese film that's not accessible in any way that came out in 2017. And also print a zine with an interview with the director.
Some years ago, I saw The Real Cancun there.
Oh, man.
Which was a great experience.
Oh, that rules.
Have you seen The Real Cancun?
I feel like we watched it for an episode, or maybe we just talked about it. I don't know.
Maybe we just talked about it. You should check it out. It's pretty nuts.
So the Spectacle Theater, another place to check out. Come down to New York City.
Yeah, have you heard of it, guys?
So we're not going to do our usual patter because we've been running long, and we'll have an episode about Mr. Bruce, of course, your favorite Bruce, next week. So until then, my name is Justin the Clue.
I'm Will Sloan.
Thanks for listening.